The following program is a Nightingale Conant production for Simon & Schuster Audio.
One cause of a poor self-image, a lot of people use unfair comparisons of experiences which really have nothing to do with ability. For example, one night for some weird reason, which I'll never be able to understand, when we lived over on Dilbeck Lane in Dallas, there'd been a lot of rain. I decided that night of all nights I was going to put my car in the garage. I decided to come down the back alley, which was not paved. That is mistake number one. I got stuck hopelessly just outside of my own house there in the back alley. And I worked and I sweated and I burned a little rubber and so forth trying to get out of there that night. And finally I said, well, you know, nobody else is going to be foolish enough to try to come down this alley tonight. I'll just leave it here overnight. Next morning I called the tow truck. You know, negative people call wreckers, but I needed a tow truck to get out of there. The gentleman came around and he had a very limited education. I mean, every word he said indicated that. He took a look at it, and incidentally, before I called him the next morning, I'd really been out there trying to get the car out. I'd thrown sand and bricks and boards, and I'd burned enough rubber to drive from here to Jackson, Mississippi and back trying to get out of that hole. And finally, I gave up in frustration and called the tow truck. This old gentleman looked at it for a minute, and he said, "Let me see your keys." I said, "What you gonna do with them?" He said, "I believe I can drive this car out." I said, "Man, there ain't no way. I've been working on this thing all of this time." And he said, "Well, I'd like to give it a try." Well, I'm such a gracious, kind, considerate, understanding fellow. I didn't want to embarrass the old fellow, and so I gave him my keys. And I was all prepared when he failed. I was going to be kind and gracious about it. I was going to say, "Well, you know, it was buried in there pretty deeply. Don't feel badly about it. I mean, I worked at it myself trying to get out of here." He got in the car, turned on the ignition, cranked the engine, turned the car just a tad to the left, rocked it twice, and in about 7 seconds drove it right out of there, just slickering a button. It was so easy that when he circled the block and came back, he was embarrassed about it. He wouldn't even look me in the eye, you know. And I said, "Man, how on earth did you manage to do that?" Well, he said, "I was raised over here in East Texas." He said, "I've been driving out of gullies deeper than that since I was 12 years old." Now, that fellow was not smarter than I was. He had a different experience. See, don't ever feel inferior because somebody else has had a different experience. I would be absolutely lost back in our shipping department. I really would. Trying to ship something at the right price to the right place and have it labeled correctly, I would be lost. Don't compare experiences. A lot of times, for example, we look at a doctor in absolute awe. And that includes me. I am amazed that they can even learn those big words, much less identify them with certain parts of the body and certain ways you feel and all that kind of good stuff. But when you realize the number of years they went to school, the thousands of hours they spent in preparation, the chances are good that had you spent the same amount of time or had I spent the same amount of time, we too could be physicians. But I'll tell you what, I'll bet you, $9 to a nickel again, my favorite non-bet. If that brilliant physician were given your job right now, he would be totally incapable of handling it until he had acquired the experience which you have of handling it. It is fine to admire other people and other professionals. I do. I know you do too. It's fine to admire them, but that's got nothing to do with your position on the totem pole. You're good at what you do, and you can get better at what you do. There are roughly 1 billion Chinese on the face of this earth, and all of them, a year old and older, can do something that I can't do, and I'll bet you can't either. They can speak Chinese. Now, does that mean they're smarter than we are? Or does it just mean that they've had a different experience? There are about 7 million Australians that can do something that would scare me to death. They can drive down the wrong side of the highway. Now, does that mean they're smarter than we are? No, it just means they've had a different experience. What I'm saying out of all of this, you need to concentrate on the positive and not the negative. Don't feel inferior because somebody else can do something better than you can do. I was listing the things the other day that I cannot do. I cannot really fill out my own tax form. I couldn't take out my own tonsils. I can't repair my own teeth. I know nothing about repairing an automobile. As a matter of fact, I had a mechanical bypass when I was very young. I cannot fix anything of an electrical nature. There are thousands of things I cannot do. Now, that doesn't bother me, and I hope it doesn't bother you. The other people can do those things. I know how to talk, and I know how to write. And those are the things which I concentrate on. What am I saying? I'm saying find your strength and develop those strengths. Since we cannot be champions at everything, many people have a natural tendency to play down the talents or qualities in which we do excel. In the process, we occasionally end up with phony humility. We shouldn't think in terms of being better or worse than anyone else. As individuals, we are unique and different from anybody else. There have been 11 billion people to walk this earth, approximately. There's never been two who were exactly alike. I can honestly say to you that you truly are unique. You very definitely are different. And we need to understand that. It will help our self-image. What can be a factor in poor self-images? Well, race can be a factor. In our society particularly. I never realized the seriousness of this until I was watching, I guess it was about 20 years ago, a movie or a presentation on television with Bill Cosby. It was sponsored by the Xerox Corporation. Now, when I was a child, Shirley Temple was one of my favorites. I used to get the biggest charge out of watching her, you know, singing her little songs and on the good ship Lollipop. I thought it was the cutest thing I ever saw in my life. I really did. But Bill Cosby let me look at it through the black man's eyes. And I saw it altogether differently. Let me play the scene for you. It's a birthday party. Shirley Temple is about 5 or 6 years old. The scene opens and she is bidding her little friends goodbye, thanking them. You know, she's a very personable little girl. And then a black girl who appeared to be about 14 years old and two or three of her friends came up as the party was ending and the older girl had a little present in her. She said, Miss Shirley, we brought you a present. And what did Miss Shirley do? She said, oh, thank you very much. And we have some leftover birthday cake. Why don't you come and have some? And the little girl said, oh, Miss Shirley. I'll tell you, when you get that picture, it's easy to understand the tremendous negative impact when a black child would watch that and see what was being stereotyped there. That day was an eye-opener for me. I learned to see my black brothers and sisters in an entirely different way. The way you treat people, you see, can have a dramatic impact on the image that individual has. Race can definitely be a factor. I was so delighted to see Doug Williams do well in the Super Bowl. But isn't it tragic that so much was made out of it? And the reason I say that so much was made out of it, it should have been hardly mentioned. It should have been simply, well, what do you expect? Here's a superb athlete, a magnificent football player, had a great team behind him. The fact that he was black indicates, ladies and gentlemen, that we've still got a long way to go in this area. And I hope we will all work on it more and more. What's the cause of a poor self-image? Og Mandino, in his book, The Greatest Miracle in the World, said that a couple of things came along. A fellow named Darwin, who said we were, you know, created from lower life. And another fellow named Freud, who said that our thoughts and actions originated from early childhood experiences. They're deeply buried in our subconscious mind, which we could neither control nor understand, and for which, therefore, we are not responsible. With one scientist saying we came from animals, and the other saying there's nothing we can do about ourselves, no wonder some people have poor self-images. For what it's worth, Darwin, before his death, recognized God as the architect of the universe and contributed much money to Christian missionaries before his death. An article in Psychology Today revealed that of all of the concepts that Freud brought forth, there has not been a single one of them, not one, which has been scientifically validated. John Hopkins psychologist Robert Hogan said this, "Freud thought you could study neuronics and learn about normals. He got it backward. You have to study the normal to understand the delinquent." And I believe, of course, he is 100% right. What are some other causes of a poor self-image? Pornography is one of the causes of poor self-image. Now, why would that be? It is simply because, number one, it is particularly demeaning to women. Number two, pornography pictures mankind as being almost entirely animalistic. It leaves out all of the tender, understanding, loving compassion. Some psychologists have said that when you watch one pornographic movie three times, like a Deep Throat, for example, that it has the same impact as one actual experience along those lines. Soap operas and the horoscope are a couple of things that are not good for the self-image. I challenge anybody on the soap opera with this statement. I believe it is impossible to watch them every day and remain optimistic and morally sound. I don't believe you can do it. I challenge you to do this. Take your Saturday's newspaper, if you really want to have some family fun, take your Saturday's newspaper, clip out the weekly summation of the soap operas, cut them up, giving each family member, two of them, challenge them to stand up and read with a straight face what has happened to those people all week long. You cannot do it. But when you view them, you know, with the music and the drama there, they are very, very addictive. They really are. Horoscope? Well, let me tell you the problem with horoscopes. Basically, when the redhead and I were in England touring there about 4 years ago, we went to the castle of Henry VIII. We saw the magnificent castle where he was. We saw the famous clock that he had created, and we saw the picture that they believed was true in those days, that the sun revolved around the earth. It is upon that theory that the horoscope is written. Now, if that's science, I did have monkeys as ancestors. Now, the thing that is the difficulty, the thing that creates the problem, is this. The horoscope will make you fatalistic. When you start reading it every day, and how many times have I had people say, "Oh, I just look at it, don't pay any attention at all to it." Then why read it if you don't pay any attention at all? It can become addictive, and it can influence your behavior. The greatest single cause of a poor self-image is the absence of unconditional love. The beautiful thing is we can do something about that. Love is one of those things which is so powerful and so important. I was in Melbourne, Australia last summer as part of our tour. We'd been to Japan to look at their factories and their schools and to see what they were doing. We went on to other areas of the country. We went into Hong Kong to do what we could about the local economy. We went from there on down to Malaysia. And in Malaysia, we had a speaking engagement. Then we went on down to New Zealand, had a couple of engagements there, and then to Australia. Ended up in Melbourne. At one of the sessions, a lady came up to me and she said, "Mr. Ziegler, I'm 32 years old. I've got your tapes. On one of the tapes, you keep saying, 'Tell your children that you love them. Tell them that you love them.'" She said, "In my 32 years of life, nobody has ever told me they loved me. I've never said to my little girls, 8 and 10 years old, that I love them. But I kept playing that tape, and you kept telling me, 'Tell them you love them. Tell them you love them.' You even said that if you don't tell them, when they grow up and get married, that they will never tell your grandchildren that they're loved. Somebody has got to break the chain." One day she said, "I blurted it out that I loved them." They were in considerable shock for a moment. And then they both just grabbed me and started hugging. And from there on in, it was much easier. And Mr. Ziegler, she said, "You cannot believe the psychological problems that my two little girls had. They were terrible, awful, including a reversion to infantile behavior. But within 60 days after I started telling them that I loved them, 98% of those psychological problems were solved. The ancient prophet said it well when he said that love never fails. I'm just absolutely convinced that it will overcome an awful lot of mistakes. Now, please understand, the last thing I ever want to do is hang a guilt trip on anybody. The past is behind us. And if we go back and say, "Oh, if I'd done this, things would have been different," then I have failed in this recording. We want to look to the future. We did, I'm convinced as a parent, though I made many mistakes, we did in my family the best we could with the information we had under the circumstances that existed at that time. And I'm confident that you did exactly the same thing. Let's forget the past, except using the experience as a learning experience. Let's take new information, a new look at the future. Use what we have. We can do something about the future. There's nothing we can do about the past. Poor self-image manifests itself in the way we handle our personal lives. You tell a youngster with a poor self-image that he ought to stay away from drugs, they'll kill you. And his response, at least internally, many times is, "Don't tell me that. My friends tell me that they make you feel good, make you feel big. Besides, suppose they're not good for me. What difference does it make? I'm a nothing. I'm a nobody. Got nothing to lose." A person with a good self-image would not respond in any such manner. You tell a youngster, "Study for his lessons and obey the law." If he's got a poor self-image, many times they're so negative they say, "It won't do me any good. You know, the deck's artist act. I came on the wrong side of the tracks. The rich kids are going to get all of their breaks. Why shouldn't I have a little fun right now?" You'd say to a youngster with a poor self-image, "You really ought to save yourself for marriage." And their instant thinking is, "Who's going to marry me? What chance have I got? Why not I have a little fun now? That's what it's all about. My peer group tells me I've got to do these things to be accepted. Since I have nothing to lose, why not go ahead?" An individual with a poor self-image is jealous without cause. Now, I'm not talking about jealousy for cause. Ladies, if he comes in smelling like joy and lipstick all over his collar, jealousy is not a manifestation of a poor self-image. That has nothing to do with it. But some people say, you know, "Oh, I just love him so much, I can't let him out of my sight. Or I just love her so much, I don't want her out of my sight." What they're really saying is, "I don't understand why this person married me in the first place. I certainly do not deserve him or her." A jealous, critical nature is one of the manifestations of a poor self-image. They can't handle constructive criticism, much less criticism itself. One of the interesting manifestations of a poor self-image is old motor mouth. We once had one who worked for us. Now, there's a guy that if you ask him what time it was, he would tell you how to build a clock. I mean, literally, you have seen people who are like that. You know, they corner you, or they come visiting you and they start talking and they talk and they talk. I mean, incessantly they talk. And finally, you persuade them that it's time for them to leave, or else they give you some indications that they're going to leave. And they get to the front door and they open the door and they talk another 5 minutes there in the door. And if you happen to have visited their house and you're trying to leave, they follow you all the way out to the car. And as you're backing out, they're signaling you to roll down the window. They got one more thing they want to tell you. I see some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. The class clown is a typical example of an individual with a poor self-image. They come in a couple of minutes late, you know, and distract everything. Oh, have you already started class, Miss Brown? Oh, did we have any assignment today? They're people who feel they cannot attract any attention on their own. Therefore, they got to make a show of that nature. Now, on the other end of the scales, on occasion, the quiet ones also have a poor self-image. They don't think they've got anything at all to offer. They read somewhere that still water runs deep and that it is better to remain silent and let people think you're not smart than it is to speak up and let everybody know that you're not smart. So they, a lot of times, the very quiet ones. But let me stress that in the case of the class cut-up, the motor mouth, or the quiet ones, the key word is that could be the manifestation of a poor self-image. Not always. If a person exhibits any of these three characteristics, he does not necessarily have a poor self-image, but the odds are pretty good that he does. I mention this because if any of these characteristics describe you, the identification process will encourage you to take the necessary steps so that you can do something about it. If they describe any of your friends, associates, or relatives, it will enable you to recognize them and be able to be of assistance to them. One of the manifestations of a poor self-image is a lack of commitment. People don't set goals. You see, they figure this. If I make a commitment, if I set a goal, if I say that I'm going to do this, and then it doesn't work out, then what that does is it further destroys my self-image. Therefore, if I don't make the commitment, then there's no way I can fail at the project. Negative people, as I said earlier, seldom are very persistent because they simply do not believe they can accomplish any objectives. Poor self-image is manifested a lot of times, particularly in the way we treat people in a subservient position. One of the things that bothers me the most is when I see someone abuse another individual who cannot defend themselves. For example, a waiter or waitress, in many cases, cannot properly defend themselves. Somebody who is in a position of a shipping clerk or a file clerk or somebody you know who really is at an entrance level position, they cannot properly defend themselves. I think the most irritated I've ever been with anybody is one day an associate of mine abused my secretary. Not the one I have now. This was years before that. That was most unfair and completely uncalled for. If he wants to fight, he should fight with me. I can fight back. But she was not in position to fight back. A person who will do that, you can just put your last penny on it. There's an individual who really has a distorted sense of values and who also does have a poor self-image. A lot of times, a new employee with a poor self-image will come in and make some unrealistic promises about what they can do. The new coach sometimes does exactly the same thing. A lot of kids with poor self-images always insist on picking up the tab for the Cokes. Buddies get together, you know. They don't deserve to be friends with anybody on their own merit, but if I pick up the tab for the Cokes, then, you know, I'm a good guy, and they'll accept me as part of the group, and I'll be invited back in. It used to bother me before I got into this years and years ago when I was in sales management. I would watch salespeople who I knew were broke. If it hadn't cost but 50 cents to go around the world, they couldn't have gotten out of sight. And yet, I have seen some of them absolutely insist on picking up the tab every time the group went out anywhere. They did not feel that they could be accepted on their own. Self-image is so important. I want to read something here that is so important that I didn't want to take a chance on just verbalizing it and not communicating exactly what I wanted to say. The person with a poor self-image doesn't move successfully into management. He fears rejection by the people over him, under him, or around him. He often steps out of character and dons one of four ill-fitting masks. He tries to be good old Joe and assures his subordinates that nothing has changed. He desperately tries to be one of the gang. Second, in his fear of rejection by his former peers, he makes concessions and exceptions that go beyond the principles of good management. Sometimes he does the opposite and takes an arrogant, I have arrived approach, which causes resentment among his former peers. Third, he may be unduly concerned about his relationship with management. And in his anxiety to please, he becomes too servile, eats too much humble pie, and seeks too much advice. He has an exaggerated fear of failure because he sees his worth in terms of never failing. Ironically, this fear of failure causes him to hesitate too long before taking any action. This unrealistic hesitancy is often the cause of failure. Fourth, the manager with a poor self-image may assume a know-it-all attitude, seek advice from no one, and set out to show everyone that he knows how to run the ship. A poor self-image is manifested in every walk of life. Even good old Joe, or Josie, have the problem, which is a common one and is no respecter of age, sex, education, size, or skin color. He has the I must be a nice guy and never offend anyone kind of a self-image syndrome. And listen, as a youngster, he smokes cigarettes he doesn't want, takes the drink he doesn't like, laughs at dirty jokes that actually offend him, joins the gang he secretly dislikes, and goes along with illegal or immoral conduct, and participates in a dress code he secretly abhors. All because he has never accepted himself and is terribly concerned that if he asserts himself and crosses his peer group, he will not have any friends. As an adult, he has a tendency to tell people only what he thinks they want to hear. He would never send an overcooked steak back to the kitchen. He even gives up his place in the barbershop, lets others take his parking spot, or even crash the line in front of him. He doesn't argue with the boss nor object when a coworker takes credit for work he has done. Now, don't misunderstand. If you are Joe, and your self-image is so healthy, you can conduct yourself in this manner because this is what you want, that's okay. If you view these incidents as minor or small stuff that mean nothing in your game plan for life, then your self-image is in excellent shape. However, if you do these things to gain acceptance, you're gaining everything but acceptance. The reason is simple. You're not presenting the real you. In fact, you're presenting a phony, and most people, including other phonies, don't like a phony. It was a proud moment, a very proud moment. The new citizens of the United States were at the ceremony. They were going to be inducted, they were going to become official citizens of the United States. And the man in charge was And he said to them, now we have some questions we want to ask of you. The first question is, identify the source of this quote. I regret that I have but one life to give for my country. Silence. Nothing. He looked around. Then a little Japanese boy popped up and he said, Nathan Hale, 1776. And the man in charge said, that's absolutely right. He said, all right, I have a second question. This one took place in Virginia. A young man spoke up and he said in front of the Virginia House of Commons, I don't know what course you may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. Young Japanese boy popped up again and he said, "Patrick Henry, 1775. Little voice from the rear muttered, "Darn Jap." The man in charge looked somewhat startled. He said, "Who said that?" The voice came back, "Lee Iacocca, 1985. Relationships are enormously important. They affect all ages, all colors, all beliefs, all creeds. We have to deal with both the male and the female. Our relationships are enormously important. I just love what George Washington Carver had to say. This gentle, humble botanist once advised, "How far you go in life depends on your being tender with the young, impassionate with the aged, sympathetic with the striving, and tolerant of the weak and the strong. Because someday in life you will have been all of these." That is so true. Carver was one of the most unique men in the history of our country. He was a man who is forever recognized as being the founder of Tuskegee University. Carver said one day he was in prayer and he was saying, "God, I want to serve you. I want to do what you want me to do. I would like for you to reveal to me the mysteries of the universe." And according to Carver, at that precise moment, a peanut fell at his feet. And the Lord spoke to him and he said, "George, the peanut is more your size." He said it was a very interesting experience. But he decided to settle for the peanut instead of the universe. And he discovered 300 different uses of the peanut and 118 uses for the sweet potato. You see, when you look at something like that, you can see tremendous opportunity even in a peanut. What we're going to be doing today is looking at the tremendous opportunity inside the human being. There's more misery, more frustration, anxiety, and grief because of improper relationships than any other single factor. We have more joy, however, more happiness, more excitement because of proper relationship than of any other factor. So relationships, obviously, because they start at the beginning of life and continue to the end of life, and because they involve us all of our life in between and determine our effectiveness with our family, with our friends, with our associates, with everybody else, relationships then are extraordinarily important, and having the proper attitude in those relationships are extremely important. I believe this next little story sums it up quite well. The story goes that a man was being given a chance to look at both heaven and hell so he could make a decision as to which place he really wanted to go. So they took him into the halls of hell, first of all. And as he walked in, he thought to himself, "Boy, now if this is hell, this is for me." Because there were a large number of people seated at a real long banquet table. And on the banquet table, they had every kind of food that you could possibly imagine. They had all of the vegetables, all of the salads, all of the meats, all of the entrees, all of the desserts. They had every exotic food that's available in this world today. But as the man looked at the people who were there, he noticed that even though there was a feast in front of them, they appeared to be starved. As a matter of fact, there was no laughter, there was no gaiety, nobody was having any fun at all. And yet right in front of them was a feast that anybody would have loved to have had. And then they took him over into heaven. And over there he walked in and he saw identically the same menu. Had the long banquet hall in front of him. The long banquet table was there. Had these magnificently attractive foods, exactly the same menu as had been there over in hell. But he noticed these people were all laughing and singing and having a marvelous time. They were well fed. They were healthy. And the visitor who was taking the tour turned to his guide and says, "Well, I'm a little puzzled." He says, "As a matter of fact, I'm very puzzled. I could not help but notice that they had the same menu, the same food in the other place, but over there they were starving. Over here, in reality, they're having a wonderful time. They're well fed, they're healthy. What on earth is the difference?" And the tour guide said, "Well, had you looked very carefully, you would have noticed that in both places there is a knife and a fork strapped to the arms of each one of the inhabitants. And the knife and the fork are both 4 feet long. And over in hell, what they're trying to do is they're trying to feed themselves, but they cannot. But in heaven, you see, they are feeding the person directly in front of them, who in turn is feeding them." That pretty well sums up the gist of what I'll be talking about. Because you see, it is true that you can have everything in life you want if you will just help enough other people get what they want. As we look at relationships, let's very quickly review what everyone wants in life. Everyone wants to be happy. Everyone wants to be healthy. Everyone wants to be at least reasonably prosperous. Everyone wants to have friends. Everyone wants to have peace of mind. Everyone wants to be secure. Now, for those who have families, they obviously want to have good family relationships. Now, as we look at the six basics that everybody wants, let's look at the role that relationships play. All of the authorities will tell you that your health, to a very large degree, depends on how well you get along with other people. Everybody will agree that how happy you are depends to a very large degree on your relationship with other people. Many will tell you that your amount of prosperity is determined by a large degree as to how well you get along with others. Ohio State University, as a simple example, did a study of the 50 reasons that people lose their jobs. And they had to get to reason number 16 before it had anything to do with their technical expertise or their job skills. Their first 15 dealt with attitudes and their ability to cooperate with, get along with other people. Your relationship certainly will determine the number and quality of friends that you have. Your relationships will determine to a large degree just how much satisfaction and peace of mind you have. Your relationship will determine just how secure you are, because the most insecure feeling in the world is to know that you have no one who really loves and cares for you. And the most secure feeling, every time I see anyone who is ill, the first thing they talk about is whether they are alone or whether their friends and family have been supportive of them. And of course, the key to good family relationships is the way you get along with those people. Now, this session is going to involve lots of stories, parables, examples, analogies, and quotations. As always, I'll identify the source of my information when it's possible. Now, I do always identify the source for three basic reasons. Number one, it is the right thing to do. Number two, it indicates to a degree that I've done my research. And number three, in the event it is wrong, I can always say, "You know, that fellow ought to know better than that." Or, "I can't believe that lady didn't know any better than that." Now, in the book of Mark, we read, and I quote verbatim from one of the Bibles, "By parable taught he them, and without a parable taught he not them." He's talking about Christ's relationship with his disciples. So we're going to be using a lot of parables and a lot of stories. Also, psychologist Renee Fuller has discovered that storytelling is the key to learning. You see, people remember stories. And if the story has a real moral to it, a real lesson in it, then we will remember the lesson. As a sales trainer, for example, I do a one-hour session on one single sales story that I spent no more than 20 minutes in the entire transaction, and yet there are 25 specific lessons that I extract from that one story that took place from a sales training, sales presentation point of view. And people remember it simply because they can identify with the story. Now, there's no way on earth that Mr. Abernathy could have known that when he was spending that extra time with little Joby Harris, that he was developing the boy and helping form his philosophy of life, and that that boy later would have such a dramatic impact on his future son-in-law's life, make him a better husband and a better father to the grandchildren, which he never had the privilege of seeing. In relationships, what I'm saying is, we never really know just how far we're going to influence not only that life or someone else's life. We need, therefore, to be very careful in our relationships. I so vividly recall that in contrast to another one of my World War II stories. They put us in the service. They put us in college in order to get us ready for going into the flight school. The first day in one of the particular classes, I was in English. The teacher there was reputed to be the toughest teacher anywhere under any circumstances. She truly was a big lady, about 6 feet 2 inches tall, had shoulders like a linebacker, and she was really an imposing physical specimen. They said that she was an absolute genius on the subject of English, that she knew it better than anybody in the entire state. When she walked in, she looked at the class and she said, "Class, I'm your teacher. I want to tell you something about me so you'll know what to expect." She said, "I have been at this institution for over 25 years. And in the 25 years I have been here, there has never been but one student who made an A. I can absolutely assure you that will never happen again. That was an accident. It just slipped by. It will not take place again." "Not only that," she said, "but as I look at you, you might as well know in advance, I think it only fair to warn you, that fully one-third of you will not even pass this course." Now, I want you to get the scene. We were youngsters from all over the country gathered together at this college for the purpose of getting ready to go into the military. Most of us had had a lifetime dream of serving our country as flyers. Our entire career depended upon our passing English and all other courses. One failure and you're out. The competition was enormously tough. I heard somebody in the back say, "Boy, she is one more tough lady." And somebody else said, "Yeah, but she really knows her English." Now, that I have no doubts about. She knew her English, but she didn't know her boys, and she didn't know her psychology. We were already scared to death. I just wonder how many more would have passed the class had she walked in and said, "Now, gentlemen, I might as well tell you, this is a tough class. But I might also tell you that I am a very competent instructor." And she said, "I love English and I love boys. And I just want you to know in advance that I'm going to give it my very best. I am going to teach you what I know about the English language and about the subject. We're going to dig it in depth. If for any reason any of you fail, I just want you to know in advance it is going to be your fault and not mine, because I'm committed to teaching the most effective course I've ever taught for your benefit." I believe that would have been infinitely, infinitely better. You see, what I really questioned is, was she a competent English teacher? When she stands up and says, "Only one has ever made an A, one-third is passed." And I wonder if she is not really saying, "I'm not really very good at teaching the subject. I know the subject, but I can't teach it." I accept full responsibility in our communications. If I do not communicate clearly to you, it is not your fault. I've always believed when somebody is speaking or teaching, if I don't understand, it's their fault. And the reason I say that, I believe anybody who understands their subject matter will be able to figure out a way to present it to me in such a manner that if I work, and if I accept my responsibility of learning and paying attention and really digging into it, that if then I do not learn, I believe the teacher's got to carry the major share of the responsibility. I want you to know that I accept that responsibility. I believe and believe strongly that out of this series, you're going to get a tremendous amount of information that will make you more effective in whatever you do. And I don't care what it is, communications and relationships are still going to be involved. We're going to concentrate on our ability and the importance of looking for the good. A study was done in New York City a number of years ago on the self-made millionaires there. They selected 100 of them. And as they did their study, they discovered they had a tremendously varied background. They ranged in age from the early 20s to the late 70s. They ranged in educational background from about the fifth grade to one had two PhDs. Something like 60 or 70% of them came from towns of less than 15,000 people, for whatever that means. But the thing that they found that was absolutely consistent, that each one of them had in common, was that every one of them had the ability to see the good in other people and in other situations. So if we really start understanding that we need to be good finders and encouragers, then we've learned a very important lesson. The story is told of a businessman who went down to catch the subway. And he was in kind of a hurry. There was a beggar at the entrance to the subway selling pencils. The businessman reached in his pocket. He popped a dollar down into the tray where the pencils were and hurried to get on the subway. But after he'd gotten on the subway, he still had a minute or so before it was to leave. He got back off. He went over to the beggar selling the pencils and he reached down. He said, "You know, I owe you an apology. I was in such a hurry that I forgot. You're selling a good product, fully worth the price. You're a businessman, just like I am. I'll take my two pencils." Many months later, at a social event, the businessman encountered a well-dressed young man there who came up to him and said, "There's no way on earth you would ever recognize me." But he said, "Many months ago, I was selling pencils in the subway station, and you gave me my dignity. You did not treat me like a beggar. You treated me like a businessman. I want to say thank you." I wonder how many beggars, had they been treated like businessmen and women, would not be beggars today. Somebody said once, "It's nice to be important, but it's more important to be nice." I believe that's true. One of the most significant events of my first year in Dallas, Texas, when we moved here back in 1968, was the meeting of a man who has since come to be a very close friend of mine. His name is Walter Haley. He, at that time, was in the insurance business. He had conceived a new idea. He was selling insurance to the independent grocers around America via selling them as they bought and dealt with the warehouse. In other words, these monstrous warehouses, when they would bill the groceries to these independent grocers all over the country, Mr. Haley gave them the idea of billing them for their insurance for all of the employees. I'm talking about life insurance as well as health and accident insurance. His average salesperson was selling $10, $15, $20 million worth of whole life insurance. That was the rage in those days. Whereas the average life insurance agent was selling in the neighborhood of about $1 million. And it took a pretty good one to sell $1 million. A friend of mine said, "I want you to meet Walter Haley. He's a most unusual man." Well, you know how some people have chemistry. You meet them and you've been friends for life. Well, Walter Haley has that charisma about him that when you meet him, you want to get to know him better. Walter is a very short man. I suspect he's about 5 feet, 5 inches tall or something along those lines. Might be a little taller. I've never really took a careful measurement of how tall he was. But when Walter Haley stuck out his hand, the first thing he said, "Zig, I've been hearing about you. Man, I am just flattered that you've come over to see me. And I can't wait to show you around and let you see what's going on." We walked into a warehouse and I was stunned. I didn't know there was that much food in the world, much less under one roof. As we walked in, he said, "Excuse me one second, Zig." He walked over to the switchboard operator and he said, "I'm Walter Haley." And he said, "I just want to tell you that I think you're doing an absolutely magnificent job on this switchboard. You know," he said, "I never dial this number that I don't get the distinct impression that all you're doing is sitting there waiting for me to call so you can put me through to the proper person." He said, "You just do a beautiful job." She said, "Well, thank you, Mr. Haley. I really appreciate that." He said, "Well, I appreciate you." We left and we were walking down one of the corridors and he said, "Excuse me a second, Zig." He stepped in the office and he stuck his hand out. He said, "I haven't met you. I'm Walter Haley. I haven't had the privilege of even seeing you before, but I've been reading the reports and watching what's happening since you took over." And he said, "Man, you're just doing an absolutely magnificent job, and I want to thank you for it." The man smiled, of course, very broadly and said, "Well, Mr. Haley, I do the best I can." And Walter Haley said, "That's good enough for me. You just keep it up. You're really doing a marvelous job." We left there, we walked upstairs, and we walked into Walter's office, and the first person we saw was his secretary. And he said, "Zig, shake hands with the greatest secretary who ever sat behind a desk." And he said, "You know, my wife thinks you hung the moon. And she thinks you can take it down just whenever you want to. And I'm going to ask you to please leave it up there. I love to see it as I'm riding, especially on my way down south at night." "Oh, Mr. Haley," she said, "you're always saying something like that. And your wife is really a sweet lady. But I just want you to know, keep it up. I really like to hear it." We walked into his office and there sat an insurance rep. And Walter Haley said, "Zig, shake hands with one of the greatest life insurance men to ever put on a pair of shoes." He said, "Oh, Walter, you're always saying things like that." But he said, "I love it. I love it." Now, the entire trip took less than 10 minutes. How many of you, though, believe that as a result of that 10 minutes, those four people had a marvelous day? Absolutely. He had built them up. Now, I want to stress something very important, because this is the key to the whole thing. If you're sincere, it's enormously effective. If you're insincere, it's manipulative. Now you see, when you're manipulative, the manipulator will say and do things so that he or she can win. Today, Walter Haley is, quote, retired, about as retired or unretired as anybody on the face of this earth. He's busier than ever. He's a multi-millionaire, has friends everywhere he goes. He's what we call a happy miser. He saves every friend he makes. He believes you can never get ahead by trying to get even. I think he's right. The motivator understands that it's a win-win situation. You're not doing it for your benefit. You do it for their benefit. But when they benefit, you benefit. And we go right back to the whole concept that you can have everything in life you want if you will just help enough other people get what they want.